All right, guys, we are live. Welcome back to Pseudo Intellectual. Thank you so much for joining us today, especially you live viewers. And hey, guys, don't forget, if you are people who enjoy listening to podcasts, you can find us on every single podcast platform there is. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe, all of that good stuff. Today, we have a very, very fiery, very spicy, very topical conversation with Megan Basham. I've been following her for years. She is the culture reporter at the Daily Wire, and she is an author. She's got a new book that's going to be coming up in just a couple months, so we're going to be talking about that for sure. Megan, it's so nice to speak to you.
You as well. I would say I've seen you around the Daily Wire offices now and then, you know, when we've had big events going on, but it's good to be on your show now, on your turf.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, this is such a great time to have you on. Here we have your book, which, guys, you can find in the description. It's linked. Like I said, it's not out yet, but you can pre-order. It's called Shepherds for Sale: How Evangelical Leaders Traded the Truth for a Leftist Agenda. I mean, this is just, I'm struggling to think of what a more topical conversation could be. So your timing with this is just dead on. You're almost, I mean, you've got to have some foresight, because this is something that's at kind of the forefront of the conversation politically and culturally right now. So would you mind giving us a little bit of a, I guess, a description about what the book is all about?
Yeah, you know, probably the easiest thing to do is to kind of give you a little bit of my background and how I came to write it, because I think I experienced what a lot of people were experiencing, which was, you know, before I came to the Daily Wire, I was at a Christian well-known magazine, World News Group, World Magazine. And I loved it there. And by the way, I always want to preface these things so there's no confusion. World really righted the ship on some things that were happening there. But during the time before I left, a year, 2 years before I left to go to the Daily Wire, the then editor-in-chief just totally started to change in ways that shocked me. You know, I'm working in a Christian magazine, been there for, you know, either as a contractor or an editor or later as a podcast co-host for 15 years and no issues, totally solid. And then suddenly, right around 2020, like, racial justice became really important in how our coverage was framed, even if the stories weren't racial. Like, and then the editor instituted a racial team that was going to start review, and it was kind of secret. We didn't know who was on it. And they were going to be reviewing our work with a lens to how racially sensitive we were. And that shocked me. I went, wait a minute, what is this? And then, you know, I had colleagues sort of harassing me over my coverage. You know, I was on a news podcast at that point. One of the things I covered was, for example, the Atlanta shooting, if you remember that, in the spa. Right, very quick news hit, I didn't mention the race of the victims that were predominantly Asian, but not entirely Asian. And it wasn't clear that that was a feature of the story. So I didn't bring it up. We didn't know that that was the motive. So I just very kind of quickly ran through in a news hit what happened. I had a colleague emailing me saying that she was devastated. It left her in tears that I didn't mention the race of the victims. So things like this were going on, and it got to the point where I just didn't want to deal with it anymore. And that was how I ended up over at Daily Wire. But it set me on a path of going, what's happening in the church? Because that, and similar issues were happening with COVID in this organization. So I started going, I don't know what's happening. I feel like the place that I worked, the ministries that I trusted, the publications that I used to read and really value are all kind of going off the rails. Why is this happening? So when I got to Daily Wire, I started reporting on those things. Probably the first big piece that I did that blew up was tracing how Francis Collins, who was Anthony Fauci's boss at that time at the National Institutes of Health, suddenly started appearing on all these Christian podcasts and ministries and doing interviews. And come to find out, you know, he was in some cases directly partnering with some of these ministries formally with the federal government to push COVID propaganda to people in the pews. And so that led to a deeper dive of, you know, what are they doing in immigration? Because you would see these sort of, one is called the Evangelical Immigration Table. And major pastors and Christian authors were a part of this organization and publishing letters to say, turns out, hey, evangelicals want amnesty policies. They want you to back, you know, things like Senator Lankford's bill. And I went, why is this happening? So I started digging into it. And you come to find out, oh gosh, that particular organization has received funding from George Soros. So really what I think and what I discovered all over is that a lot of left-wing foundations started targeting evangelicals because they're a massive voting bloc. Like Atlantic has called them the America's most powerful voting bloc. They make up 35% of the electorate. So if you take them out of the equation, the right doesn't win anything anymore. They will win no legislative fights. They will lose all of their, you know, policy goals. So that was really when I started looking into it. And then on the left side, what was really fascinating is you saw, and you've probably noticed, Lauren, the massive cottage industry of books saying that the that evangelical churches have been compromised by MAGA, have been, you know, co-opted by Donald Trump. And when I started looking at it, I go, yeah, there's some fringe activity going on, but nothing mainstream. What I really discovered is, no, actually, what you're trying to do is distract from the really, you know, concrete, hard receipts backing the way you are coming into these organizations. So to me, it was, you know, very sort of a Darvo thing. We are actually doing this and we're trying to distract from that by saying, oh, look, these guys are Trumpy. Okay. Yeah. Well, they're not backed by George Soros. I can tell you that.
Right. And I feel like, you know, going to a church, especially in the South, yeah, odds are you're going to see a lot of Republicans in the pews. But I think there is a difference between that, Christians who go to church and have to be Republicans, versus the actual, I guess, evangelizing of political issues at a church. And it's funny, I see that way more happening from a left-wing perspective than the opposite way. It's like, even though most evangelicals will identify as Republican, if we were to take, and this is maybe just anecdotal, but I feel like if I were to take a gander at what political position is most being argued for, like from the pulpit, maybe this is not the issue when it comes to the abortion issue, but I often, like, it's a left-wing slant that I'm often seeing, like you said, in regard to immigration, racial issues. The response, I guess, to try to play devil's advocate here was, well, doesn't that just kind of mean and make sense that Jesus would be for social justice himself? Like, it wasn't Jesus a love your neighbor kind of guy? And the fact that the right is so alienating and divisive now, doesn't it mean that the church needs to be speaking up for these social justice causes because it is ultimately what Christ himself would have wanted? How do you feel about those types of arguments? Because I've seen a lot of those online.
I feel like it is such spiritual manipulation and, frankly, spiritual abuse, because we do not know exactly how Jesus would have felt about Senator Lankford's amnesty bill. That's insane. We do know that God invented borders, right? We know that God invented the nations. He is not against nations. He invented them. So, you know, when I see that, I go, that is such manipulation, because we are trying to put debatable issues on the same level as issues that are not debatable. Like, we know for certain that the sanctity of life is important to God, because scripture tells us he formed us in his womb, in our mother's womb. He knew us before we were born. These things are very clear. So they're taking those issues and they're trying to say that they are the moral equivalent of things that are very debatable, like, you know, how many people should we let into the country every year, and what should be the process for admittance? I mean, that is something that we should have a discussion about, because look, you can say, oh gosh, we have to love our neighbor and let anyone who claims to be an asylee in, and yet our neighbor also suffers from those policies. If you look at what happened to Lake and Riley, we know that our neighbor suffers from those policies. If you look at the people who have lost their jobs because they're being replaced with low wage immigrant populations, we know that our neighbors are suffering from that too. So what they're trying to do is take debatable policy discussions that, hey, I'm open to having, and just say Jesus would support that. Well, you don't know that, because, you know, what we know is that these things are causing other neighbors to suffer. So these are complex issues, and we should acknowledge that. And when I look at it, I go, I don't know why the church needs to be taking a position on that at all. Now, if we want to minister to refugees and asylees, we should do that. We should certainly, you know, preach the gospel to them. We should help supply for their material needs, for the people who really are in need and suffering. But that doesn't mean that we have to support certain policies. And that's what these groups are doing. They're not just saying, hey, we're going to, you know, provide food and blankets, shelter. They're saying, we are going to push you as evangelicals to back these policies. Otherwise, you don't love your neighbor and you're not a compassionate person.
And do you think that that's a strategy that has been successful? Because like you said, evangelicals, huge voting block, especially for the right, reliably so. Has the left succeeded at all in trying to chip away that support? Because I think it makes sense strategically for them. We see that Donald Trump is surprisingly popular among Hispanics and even among like Black males. So a lot of people are saying, well, it's a slam dunk in 2024 for him, though. But are things a little more up in the air if evangelicals and maybe even white suburban moms are being peeled away by the left?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think you're seeing two things. What it does is it convinces, I think, the people in power. Like, I just keep going to this well because this is the number one issue to voters right now. When you look at the evangelical vote as far as immigration, I think they have been successful at convincing somebody like Lankford, hey, evangelicals want this because their leadership wants it. Their leadership has, you know, in really substantial ways capitulated on these issues and agreed to sort of sell out their pulpits to push these policies. So they tend to convince a Senator Lankford and, you know, the Mitch McConnells and, you know, the GOP coalition, oh, hey, they want this. And the automatic reaction of those legislators when they hear that is to go, well, we know that this is our number one voting base. We have to have the support of evangelicals. So if they support it and if they will give us political cover, then we'll go ahead and we'll vote for it. So you will see them push forward with bills that anybody who's really paying attention on the right goes, no, that's not popular. They don't want that. And then there seems to come this, you know, overwhelming shock when actually it turns out the base isn't happy about it. And so they seem somewhat bewildered. Like, you certainly saw that with Lankford when he was running around with some Southern Baptist Convention, which, if you don't know, that is the largest Protestant denomination in the U.S., with some of their leadership. And he's supporting this and he's being told that they support this. So he pushes the bill and then he gets backlash. So I think that's one part of it. And then the other part of it is that I do think they have chipped away some of that support. I mean, I think what they managed to do was make it embarrassing to be a full-throated conservative and to acknowledge that, yes, I'm going to support Donald Trump because these are the alternatives, right? I'm not going to vote for Clinton. I'm not going to vote for Biden. So who am I going to vote for? And they turned that into an issue that a lot of evangelicals felt ashamed about. So everybody sort of had to issue their disclaimer and say, I'm not, you know, MAGA. And that was really effective.
And I think when it comes to the whole, I'm not MAGA, but I begrudgingly support Trump, I've been guilty of that myself. I'll say, you know, I don't like everything he does. He's not perfect, but overall I like Trump. But I've realized it's very rare you need to have those disqualifiers before saying you support a politician. I don't think any politician is perfect. I don't support 100% of any politician does, but I think it does speak to the fact that Donald Trump, especially amongst liberal circles and certain demographics in certain places, it's become so toxic that you do almost feel the need to preface, like, I'm not one of those guys. You know, I just kind of compare to the other. And do you think you do think that maybe that's actually the hesitancy of supporting Trump is maybe extending to the polls? Because I look at people right now politically, I think a lot of people are angry. They're frustrated. 2024 should be the time where we finally say, okay, if you want change now, now is the time for it to happen. But do you think that, I guess, the voter participation is going to be lower amongst evangelicals? Are they not fired up? Does, especially Trump coming out and giving a very milquetoast stance on abortion, does that also contribute to things?
Yeah, I think that happened. And look, I think they, in a way, they sort of trained Trump to do what he did in the sense that, you know, he's sort of feeling like, okay, if I don't have the backing of these pro-life voters anymore, then maybe they're not my constituency. And, you know, I don't excuse that. And I understand that tendency to go, hey, I'm not MAGA. But at the same time, like you said, we don't do that typically with other politicians. Right. And that became a thing that they wielded successfully to make everybody sort of distance themselves in a way that they don't on, say, the evangelicals for Biden's side. That was a real thing. That was a real movement. And you had all of these sort of evangelical, supposedly theologically conservative, respected evangelical outlets like Christianity Today, the Gospel Coalition, holding out people like Michael Ware, who, you know, was a strategist to get evangelicals to vote for Biden. He ran a PAC to get evangelicals to vote for Biden. He was in the Obama White House. And so when they would have Michael Ware on, they don't distance themselves and say, hey, we don't agree with these things that Michael Ware's team is doing. So there was none of this, we're embarrassed. And so I don't think it convinced evangelicals, hey, we're going to go vote for the left. But I do think that there is evidence that it suppressed their vote in 2020. And I think you saw some did not turn out in the way that they could have. So when you see that, that did cause a significant loss. And when I look at that, those are the things that sort of shame evangelicals. They're not going to go vote for Biden. I don't think that that effort was successful, but I do think it was successful at suppressing the turnout.
Right. Well, I mean, and on that note, especially since you report about cultural issues, we have this story that I thought was really interesting. I don't know if you guys watch Reacher. It's actually a pretty decent show on Amazon. I went in with low expectations, but I ended up liking it. The main actor from there, what's his name? Alan Richson. According to this, he has been slamming Trump and kind of his supporters, especially those who are Christian. It says, this is going to enrage MAGA fans. Trump is a racist and a con man, and yet the entire Christian church seems to treat him like he's their poster child, and it's unreal. I don't understand it. Christians today have become the most vitriolic tribe. It is so antithetical to what Jesus was calling us to be and to do. In the same interview, he tore into police officers who killed the innocent Black woman, Breonna Taylor, during a raid. That was a tragic case. I mean, so in general, this is the type of rhetoric we often see from progressive Christians.
Right.
Bad person, you should be ashamed. This is not what Jesus would want. What do you think is the best way to combat this? Because I mean, amongst families, amongst churches, friend groups, even online, I'm seeing this type of rhetoric. It was around in 2016, but I think because we're in election year, it's ramping up again. The idea that no, if you're a Christian, you should not, and you really cannot support this if you want to be true to your values.
Well, one, I question the premise. I go, look, I know a lot of people that are voting for Trump, and I know that there are some fringy groups that, you know, kind of do the Mike Flynn thing of showing up at the church and having, you know, Trump on the cover of their Bible. And I wish he wouldn't do those things. You know what I mean? I'm like, look, you're making things hard for your average evangelical voter. Don't do that. But when I look at what's happening on the left, I go, the politicization of their churches is so incredible. And everybody just turns a blind eye to it. You look at what happens as far as politicking in Black churches, welcoming Kamala Harris to come speak. I mean, it's not even comparable. Really? So I wish he wouldn't do that. But the idea that evangelicals worship Trump is such a canard. I don't for a second believe that is the mainstream evangelical view of him. I think a lot of people just are making a pragmatic choice that, look, our country's not in good shape. Unfortunately, at this point, he's gone wobbly on abortion, but he's still, you know, substantially better than what the Democrat Party is offering. So I think you have to make some pragmatic choices when you vote. What you are not doing is signing on to everything a particular candidate says or does or believes. And that has been what they're selling. And that's what that guy is selling, the Reacher. And you have to tell me his name again. I don't even remember his name.
Alan Richson, I think.
Alan Richson. Yes. So that's what he's selling, is that anything that politician owns, does, you own it. And that's ridiculous. We have never had that standard before. And then I look at this guy and I'm like, you're the guy doing some explicit sex scenes, right? So you want to tell me about your
what it means to
right, your super strong Christian convictions about conduct. I'm like, you've got some borderline pornography happening there, my dude. So you're not the guy to be making this argument. And again, you know, he brings up something that I would say is debatable. What happened with Breonna Taylor and whether it is systemic, and we can extrapolate it out to police forces all over the country. I don't think we can, but that's the argument that he's making. And he's drawing an equivalency to things that, you know, are unquestionably wicked, like confusing children about what their gender is and murdering babies. So, you know, it's funny that he feels super comfortable to do this, right? Everyone sort of praised the fact when he came out and said, oh, I'm a Christian. They're like, wow, isn't this cool that this guy in Hollywood is so open being a Christian? And I'm like, yeah, it's not really surprising because he's, you know, their regime Christian. He's, yeah, you know, the Christian on a tether who will say exactly what they want him to say.
And I feel like if you want to be an open Christian in Hollywood and not kind of face the potential boycotts or constant criticism that people like Chris Pratt do for being a Christian, you almost have to do this. You have to come out and say full-throatedly, I'm not like those Christians. I'm one of the progressive Christians. I think, you know, Jesus would love everything that progressivism stands for today. What a coincidence. And I feel like if you deviate from that, then Hollywood will basically try to blacklist and cancel you. Like I said, we kind of see that going on with Chris Pratt, who's not been political, but they just feel that even if you're only Christian, you only talk about it, there's still like an era of conservatism that they still don't like, and oftentimes they don't really want to tolerate. And when it comes to, you know, Trump or Biden, because it's always, well, how could you support Trump? He's done XYZ. I think it's interesting to bring up that point in a situation where it's not Trump versus some hypothetical amazing candidate who has all his same positions, but is simultaneously a devoted Christian. They're bringing this up when he's going up against Biden, who we know has skeletons in his closet. We know about what's going on with his son, Hunter, all his crooked business dealings. So I just find it interesting how they don't seem to have a problem supporting him, though, similar, if not worse, character flaws.
Right. And, you know, going back to that Chris Pratt thing, what makes me laugh is you don't even have to, as an actor or someone in Hollywood who's well known, you don't even have to say something conservative. You just have to not speak about it at all. And then the investigation starts. Right. I can't remember who it was, but I saw that on some actor the other day. And the question was like, he said things that sound sort of Christian. But and we don't know his political record. And it was like very concerned. And we have to investigate his political record. So you're not even allowed to just opt out. That's how draconian it has become.
And I mean, before Taylor Swift went out and, you know, came hard for the left, which I wish she had never done, it was a similar thing for her. The fact that she hadn't said anything, people were kind of, well, does that mean you're conservative? And then obviously the undertone there is, and if you are, then that's not okay. Quick super chat from I'll Fight You Naked. When the religious take absolute positions on things like abortion, I think they want to let the woke destroy the world to fulfill prophecy. Idiot. So clearly not someone who's a fan of the hardline position. And then Free Gender says, Jesus did not come to bring peace. He came with his sword to rip family members apart with the truth. Matthew 10:35. So do you think that the pro-life crowd is kind of shooting the Republican Party in the foot? Because I have seen Trump get a lot of criticism for his stance on abortion, which, by the way, you could still criticize Trump and end up voting for him. But there are, I think, not as many people, but I think this is what that comment is alluding to, those who are so frustrated that Trump isn't coming out and doing something like campaigning on a nationwide abortion ban, that maybe they don't want to vote for him at all.
Right. And, you know, I mean, look, this is a tough issue because I wrote about this myself in The Telegraph. And my issue with the pro-life lobby is in a way they have trained Trump to do what he just did. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, when Trump said something, if you remember this back in 2015, and I didn't think it was a beyond the pale comment, he suggested that perhaps there should be some sort of legal penalty for women seeking abortion if we outlaw it. Like, if we outlaw it, well, then perhaps there should be some sort of legal penalty for those who procure it. And in fact, that is the law in countries like the UK. If you go and get an abortion after 24 weeks, you could face some sort of, and I don't know what their legal penalty is, but I know that you will face some sort of fine or charge. And when he said that, the pro-life lobby lost their minds. Like, they acted like it was an insane thing to say, when in fact it was a pretty logical thing to say. So in a sense, I kind of feel like the same guys, like, for example, the leader of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, who has been out slamming Trump's comments, I'm like, you guys got a lot of nerve. Because when there was a bill, I think it was in Alabama, that would have done something that would have outlawed abortion and also would have put some kind of, and I think it was a fine, some kind of legal penalty on the table for women. They submitted a letter, and it may have been an amicus brief saying, we oppose this. We, who are supposed to be a pro-life group, representing the largest Protestant denomination in the U.S., we oppose any efforts to make an unborn child an equal person under the law. So when that happens, what is Trump supposed to take from that? Mm-hmm. So to me, in a sense, you know, they trained him to think they're not that serious about this. So you can't really be that surprised when maybe he himself does not have a real comprehensive and consistent view of how we approach the abortion issue. So, you know, that said, I kind of also feel like, look, the criticism is fair. So go ahead and make the criticism. And I have, you know, what Christians do at the end of the day, I don't see sitting out. I see that, you know, part of the way that you wield political power, and anytime you cast a vote, that's what you're doing, wielding political power. You are making a choice over who is going to do the most to put these policies in place. So I don't really like his rhetoric right now. I don't necessarily fault those who say, I don't know that I can support him based on these comments, and I hope he course corrects. And I hope that his team gets him to course correct, because I think there is a needle you can thread here where you say, Dobbs opened this up to the states. It is going to be up to the states, but then you still make it clear what abortion is. We saw that with Lincoln, right? Lincoln actually very clearly in the Lincoln-Douglas debates said, I am not going to move federally on slavery. He said that at the time, but while he was making those speeches, he was also very clear that slavery was a great evil, that it was a stain on our nation, and that even though he wasn't going to move on it because it wasn't politically pragmatic, he did not deny what it is. And so I think right now that is what the Trump team is failing to do.
Right. And I think that is a good distinction. And for me personally, it's not just, you know, when he comes out and says this should be a state's issue, I kind of understand. It's like, all right, we wanted Roe versus Wade overturned. That was accomplished through Trump's Supreme Court picks. I don't blame him for saying, okay, well, maybe now it's time for you folks at the state level to kind of do your part, because we've done it on the federal level. But then when he also comes out and says he doesn't support the Arizona ban, then I'm like, okay, you know, I was really trying to be charitable beforehand and still overall support him, especially compared to someone like Biden. But that's, like you said, I think it's bad messaging. Maybe they're being Machiavellian about it, and they're just saying this now until they get in power, and then it's his final term and they just do whatever they want on the federal level. But
Obama did that. So
exactly. Steve Grady says, and this is actually relevant to something else I want to talk to you about. So many churches are theologically weak and performative anyway. Just look at the female pastor who kicked a field goal with the Bible during their service on Super Bowl Sunday. It's become a joke. Okay, I did not hear about that, but that seems like
I saw that video. And he's totally right. You know, that's a big part of the issue is we have emasculated churches that, you know, I don't mind this language. I get hit for it sometimes, but I'm like, the longhouse is very real in our churches today. We're catering to women. They're sort of driving the bus, and I've heard it described as sinful empathy for things that they should not be empathetic towards, like the transgender lobby. That is creating, you know, massive confusion and chaos in churches.
So how do churches better connect with men? Because this is something else that I saw that I want to get your people have been talking about it. Where is it? Here we have a church that had it looks like a men's summit. Good.
You're in the presence of the Lord. Powerful things.
It looks more like a rock show. I think there's like monster trucks. Yeah, there was just a lot going on. They've for this. So how does the church connect with men, especially young men? Because I understand maybe the motivation behind this, but I don't think this is it. I don't think we need just, men love monster trucks. Let's slam them on there. What do we do? What do we do?
Right. So it's funny. I kind of did an obsessive little bit of a deep dive on what happened at this conference, because I really didn't know much about this group. I don't really know much about Mark Driscoll. And, you know, the guy, so for those who aren't familiar, there was a sword swallower who apparently has a background as a stripper, and he went up on the stage and swallowed a sword at the opening of this conference. And there was a pole involved, but he wasn't like stripping on the pole. And, you know, so then Mark Driscoll came out and rebuked the event and said this was evidence of a Jezebel spirit. And, you know, there's questions about whether this was a setup and whether it was pre-planned. And, you know, I have talked to some people who were there at this event and they don't believe it was pre-planned. So I don't know. But the whole thing does feel very performative. That I can say. The sword swallowing thing, I didn't get why it was taken as a sexual thing other than it came out that this guy had a background as a male stripper because he didn't strip at the thing. And I mean, he did have a shirt off, but they have had other performers at this, you know, very raw, manly event who were shirtless. So I wasn't really clear about that. And this guy has performed his sword swallowing act on America's Got Talent and Britain's Got Talent. So it's kind of, it was kind of a circus thing to me.
Right.
And I think that is how we should think of it. That I go, we have not given men a serious role in the church. In a very real way, we have told them that their job is to cater to female sensibilities. And so I feel like it's just leaking out now masculinity in all of these bizarre ways. And this conference is one of them because I'm like, look, men's roles in their home, in their community, in their family is a leadership role. And that's not happening and that's not being taught. And so instead you're getting being a man means monster trucks and, you know, feats of strength. I don't know. But I mean, even the, like, look, Mark Driscoll's rebuke to it, even to me, was really empty of substance. I don't know what a Jezebel spirit is. It felt like there was biblically a lot of things you could say about the chaos and performance of this event that go much deeper to why it was an issue than, you know, this particular catchphrase, the Jezebel spirit. And so that was what I would have wanted to see rebuked. But here's the good thing. I mean, I feel like while these things are coming out in weird ways, and I think we have seen that, like I know Ali Beth Stuckey has been attacked. I've been attacked. Maybe you have been attacked in the sense that they don't want women talking at all. Some of these guys who are going to such an extreme backlash. So, I mean, I think we can be critical of that while also recognizing what's driving this. I think there's such a dismissal of men's needs in the church right now that it's coming out in bizarre ways because someone's going to fill that need. Somebody's going to speak to these guys. And if it isn't good content, if it isn't real biblically grounded preaching, it's going to end up being weird performative stuff like that.
Right. And it's hard from a female perspective, because you're right. Like I do get attacked. I did a video about the rights problem with women. And one of the things that I address is that, hey, if we want more women to be conservative, then I think oftentimes women are just naturally attracted to strong men as leaders. And so we need to strengthen the church and strengthen marriage. And I think a lot of how we do that is for, I mean, women to stop trying to attack the men who are leading just because they're doing something in a way that may not appeal to us personally, but that might appeal to other men. But it's also hard when you're hearing, you know, men who say, okay, well, you just shouldn't be this involved in all. It's like, okay, well, right now the church is predominantly women, and I don't think we want to grow it by having less women involved. It's by bringing more men into the fray. And as someone who, you know, I'm born again Christian. I was baptized when I was in college. My, you know, the person who had such an impact on me ministering to me was a woman. And I think that female connection was so important. So I don't want to, I think we can empower men and have strong men in church without saying, like, to the women who are so active and who love the church, you also be less involved. And that doesn't mean that I'm in favor of, like, female pastors or anything, but, you know, for women, that sisterhood in church, I think that is something special that shouldn't be, you know, shouldn't be diminished. And that doesn't need to be in competition with the men's ministries.
Yeah. And I think part of what they have to realize too is, you know, there's sort of this question of, well, are you taking care of your families? And I kind of want to come back with, okay, the Proverbs 31 woman was very active in her community. And, you know, she had a job she did from home that she, you know, was pretty successful enough that she could go out and buy property without consulting anyone. So she just went out and decided to buy a field and buy some property and make money from that. And, you know, we live in a society now where there's a lot of opportunity for women to do that. And you're at different stages of your life. You know, I'm at a stage where I kind of want to tell these guys, look, my kids do not need as much hands-on care from me as they once did. And right now you're judging another servant. So who are you? As long as the Bible doesn't prescribe it, then it's something that I can do. And so that's legalism. You're putting up legalistic boundaries. And at the same time, I can say, as you said, I think that some of those legalistic boundaries that you're wanting to put up are coming from a real issue that you're recognizing. And that is that pastors are catering to feminine sensibilities. Let's put it that way. And it's weird because it's how women responsibly get involved in their churches. Because if you're doing the things that we see in scripture, which is, you know, ministering to your community, maybe you're making meals, teaching younger women, that's really important. The thing you just talked about that you experienced in college, I'm like, that's a command that we're to do. We as women are to teach younger women. So that's exactly what she should have been doing. I think the issue is when you have the women, like you see them right now online all the time, who were the backlash to the Mark Driscoll thing that was really weird. Like their reaction was, we're going to make t-shirts that say Jezebel and we're going to wear them proudly. Like we're now Jezebel. And I went, okay, so now you see where this stuff is coming from, because this was the other side of the coin. And it was the same kind of weird performative impulse. So you've got one side, you know, performing masculinity, you've got the other side performing this sort of belligerent feminist weird Jezebels under the name of Christian. And that was bizarre to me. I go, okay, have you guys read the Bible? Do you know who Jezebel is? I'm not wearing a t-shirt with Jezebel. Like,
you can condemn a Jezebel spirit, and I don't personally feel like that's an attack on me as a woman, because I don't identify with Jezebel at all, actually.
Right.
No, crazy stuff. So we have this from Free Gender again. There's graphic lovemaking scenes in the Bible, Genesis 38, 8 through 9. I think we have, I mean, the term graphic is doing a lot of heavy lifting here.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't think you can compare that there. Amazon Prime. He says, churches will reconnect with men when they tell their women followers to stop initiating divorce, stop taking child support, and stop taking alimony. I at least have not been to a church where they support divorce. And also, I find it very
strange. I actually think that guy's got a fair point right there.
But I don't agree with lumping child support in with alimony, personally.
Well, yeah. And here's why I think he's got a fair point, which is weird. I was just talking to a friend about this, which is that we sort of know all these young couples, and a lot of them are getting divorced, and a lot of the women are and this is anecdotal, but I think if you look at statistics, it backs it up, that the women are overwhelmingly initiating divorce. And it doesn't, you know, everyone wants to go, oh, well, it's because of abuse. Okay. In the majority of these cases, abuse is not involved.
Right. And I think, you know, we can talk about no fault divorce.
Right.
And people always say, but what about abuse? Well, abuse is a fault. So,
right.
Yeah. Right. That, I mean, it's a different thing.
But I do think, look, if the church were doing its job there, there would be some spiritual discipline for people who are trying to leave their marriages when there's no biblical justification. And that hasn't happened. And I actually think that guy brings up a good point, that that has left men vulnerable in a way that women aren't. I mean, I've seen women just kind of decide, I'm not really happy, I'm not fulfilled, I'm taking my kids and leaving. So it's hard, right? Because it's like when you hear some of these sort of cage stage manosphere, even women like Pearl Davis, who just sort of do this woman-hating thing. And you're like, I disagree with so much of this, but there's a tiny little grain of truth in there that we have to deal with. And that is the fact that I do see a lot of young women just kind of up and decide, I'm leaving my husband, I'm leaving my marriage. They don't really have grounds, and their husbands don't want the divorce, and they're losing everything. They're losing, forget about the money, they're losing their kids, living with them, having them in their lives to the degree that they want to. And that's a serious problem. So I do think, you know, part of this, and it is toxic, man, some of this sort of toxic backlash is a reaction to that.
Well, I feel like like I said, I haven't really been to many churches that are okay with divorce. But like you said, there's a difference between not supporting divorce, but also not being proactive enough in counseling couples. And I think that's a good point to make. You know, my husband and I, he's Catholic. We got married in the Catholic Church. We had to do a couples course. You know, we had to have conversations that seemed really obvious to me, at least, like money, kids, it's disagreements. But I think there's a possibility that there are some people who don't consider this before marriage. And then when, you know, the honeymoon stage wears off, maybe they encounter some difficulties, they're not sure what to do. It is sometimes the woman who just says, yeah, it's easier to just leave, especially when we simultaneously have, and this is something that Ali Stuckey talks a lot about, the almost the false gospel of self-love and self-acceptance at the same time, saying that you're perfect, you're enough. That is a perfect storm for a woman just saying, well, this isn't like bringing me joy, so I'm just going to back out of it.
Well, and even using the language, like the therapeutic language of abuse, where it's not abuse, you know, we're now applying that label to things that are just like, my husband said something mean to me that's emotionally abusive. We need to be really clear that you can't just, you know, throw those terms around. And that's what a lot of these sort of church counselors have done. And then you just get to leave your marriage because it's an easy justification. Because look, you get into any argument in a marriage, and I have a feeling that, you know, a lot of not nice things fly in some arguments. So we very easily sort of affirm this idea in women that I have been traumatized by something someone said to me. Which isn't to discount. I mean, emotional abuse is real. It happens, but we are acting like, you know, anytime that I'm not affirmed or I feel like my husband said something unkind to me, then that was abusive and I experienced trauma from that. So we're making people so fragile. How are these marriages going to survive when we're sort of, we're putting just fragility on a level with real abuse? Mm-hmm. And then the church doesn't back these guys up. They're affirming these women in sort of this, it's almost like this self-obsession with constantly examining their own feelings. And I'm like, you got to get out of yourself and serve others more, because that's what I see so much with these women when I look at their discourse online. I'm like, what it feels like is you just sit around dissecting your own reaction to everything constantly. And I don't understand how you live that way, but I imagine it would be fairly miserable to be married to someone who's doing that. And look, even as a wife, I will fully cop that there have been moments where, you know, my husband said something, didn't mean it that way, and I sort of nursed a grievance over it. And that was my problem, that I nursed the grievance. And I feel like instead of challenging women about that, we're affirming them in that.
Yeah, definitely. Valor Comics says that men's event video makes all men seem like a bunch of Cro-Magnons. You want strong men? Start with honestly studying God's word in a men's group at church. If you don't have one, start one. Prudence McFrugal says people should watch the conversation both pastors had on stage after the debacle. They modeled disagreeing with love and respect. Actually, I haven't seen that trailer for it, and a portion of the performance that got all the controversy was all I saw from that that conference. I'll Fight You Naked says monster trucks and sword swallowers sounds like divorced moms and their gay friends are marketing the church to men. That is, there's something to that. It almost seemed like a caricature of what women think men like.
Yes.
Rather than maybe something that a man would actually plan for himself.
That's why it was, yeah, it was a caricature. Yeah. That's why I went, like, my husband watched the video and kind of laughed at it. And he's like, okay, what is this?
Yeah, like, I mean, I don't know. Feel like maybe 14-year-old boys would think that's a good time, but I'm struggling to think of a man that I know in real life who'd also be like, yeah, let's do it. Free Gender says, if I have 50% custody of my child and you can't afford to take care of them, then I should get 100% custody of my child. Well, I think there's a difference between saying, like, yeah, if the mom's only getting 50% of the child, then, you know, obviously the cost should be representative of that. But there was a study out that I was looking at that most of the time women gets custody, which I don't think should be the case. I think 50-50, if you are going to divorce, unfortunately that happens, then you should not lose parental rights just because you're no longer with the mother. But there are, if the father is not involved for whatever reason, then he still has a child financially.
Right.
So something that I want to bring to your attention, I don't know if you've seen this clip, is there's been kind of a, I don't want to say a trend because I've only seen two clips, but what is it? Christopher Hitchens, he recently had a little BBC interview where he lamented the loss of Christianity in England.
It was Richard Dawkins.
Was that Dawkins? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, well, this next thing is Dawkins as well. Okay, so that makes sense. Same guy. Okay, so he was lamenting the loss of Christianity in the UK. He called himself a cultural Christian. He said that he He did not want to lose that part of UK culture, and also said that he would especially not want the Christian heritage of the UK to be replaced by another religion. So Jordan Peterson, I suppose, was asked about this, and he essentially made the argument that, well, Richard Dawkins, getting my atheist mixed up. Sorry, guys. You don't all look the same to me, I swear. He was essentially making the argument that Richard Dawkins is already a Christian because he believes in truth, and that's really Christianity. We're going to play some of the clip, but I thought that was interesting because Jordan Peterson, someone who, you know, I've listened to a lot, respect him a lot, and a lot of people, a lot of, I would say, classical liberal atheists appreciate his take on religion because he does illustrate how religion serves an important societal function, and, you know, in a quest for truth and meaning is good and important. However, I feel like there is a very big difference between the debate and discussion about the utility of religion versus actual faith and belief. And even when you ask Jordan Peterson, like I have in an interview, do you believe in God? He'll say something to the effect of, well, I act like I do, which is the same thing. That's not the same thing.
No.
So I want to get your opinion on almost this attempt to secularize faith and Christianity. But it's an interesting clip. We'll watch at least part of it. It's kind of long, though.
Your belief structure is permeated by the implicit beliefs. Dawkins believes in the truth. He believes in the redeeming power of the truth. Mm-hmm. He believes in the redeeming power of the communicated truth. Yeah. Well, there's no difference between that and worshiping the word, the divine word. It's the same thing. If that wasn't the case, the scientific enterprise wouldn't have emerged out of the Christian ethos. Dawkins, though he doesn't know it, is mostly a Christian, and so is Harris. Now, Harris has drifted off into meditative space because he had to find a God.
All levels of intellect works. Mm-hmm. It works for extremely smart people, and it works for that's really right. dumb people.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Whereas
that's why
Dawkins
so much of it's
does
encapsulated.
Not.
That's, you know, there's some real truth in that. Now, Dawkins' response to that is that's the most intellectually arrogant thing he's ever heard. But well, because, you know, oh, I see. So it's good for stupid people, but not like for smart people like me. You know, that's the
position. I'm saying it's good for everybody.
I know. But his response, I've heard him respond to that sort of thing. His response is that's intellectually arrogant. But Dawkins believes that people can easily become scientists. And they can't.
Okay. And then they kind of go into other issues. But Dawkins, his response was, oh, I hate this, the way X does bookmarks. Okay. He says, I'm a Christian, although I don't know it. Well, I certainly don't know it. He also says, I'm the last standing avatar of the rationalist spirit. I'll take it. Also, I'm still waiting for the in-person conversation Peterson keeps talking about. So Dawkins does not seem convinced that he is basically Christian. I understand in some ways what Peterson is trying to say, trying to equate Christianity with truth, which I do agree with. But then that's not to say that any scientist who pursues material truth, well, then you're basically a Christian. I want to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. I mean, I'll start by saying I love Jordan Peterson, huge fan. Even as, you know, sort of a colleague at Daily Wire, I was thrilled to get the opportunity to interview him when he first came over to Daily Wire and couldn't respect him more. He's, you know, a million light years smarter than I am.
Right.
But I think he's wrong here. Christianity is not just an assent to a certain set of truths, because the demons assent to that truth as well. I mean, we know that even the demons acknowledge that Christ is Lord. So that someone like Richard Dawkins would say, I find Christianity effective in a certain way and utilitarian in a certain way, and that makes me a Christian. No, what makes you a Christian is acknowledging Jesus Christ as your savior, who is going to save you from hell in the afterlife, and who is going to give you the Holy Spirit in this life and transform you into his likeness and image. That's what being a Christian is. So, you know, someone I think on X said, no, you can't be a Christian and not know it. And that is true. You cannot be a Christian and not know it. You have to have consciously and of your free will made that assent that Jesus is my savior. He is my Lord. And that is demonstrated in my obedience to him in how I live my life. So, you know, that said, I understand why, obviously, you know, guys like Richard Dawkins are looking around what's happening in the world, and they seem a little appalled to discover that the branch that they sawed off was what was holding up Western civilization. And, you know, now they're rather alarmed to see that Western civilization without it is crumbling. You know, I don't know if you saw it, Lauren, but there was that amazing interview that Pastor Doug Wilson of Moscow, Idaho just did with Tucker Carlson. And it was a great conversation illustrating that. And that is that if Jesus is not Lord, and if the Christian God is not God, then the government becomes God and it gets to tell you what truth is. And so you have suddenly Richard Dawkins going, I don't like what's happening. I don't like, you know, this decision that whatever our ruling elites tell us is the truth is now the truth because they believe some bonkers things that, you know, fly in the face of biology, for example. He doesn't like that. And yet you don't get the culture that we have without the Christianity that he wants but doesn't believe in. And you don't get Christianity if you don't believe in it. That is the fact. And he didn't want Christianity to dominate up to this point until he realized what the wages of secularism were.
The wages of secularism. I love that. I love that. That is so good. Are you familiar with Carl Benjamin or Sargon of Akkad?
I'm not.
So he is this, he's kind of one of the original political YouTubers that I've been watching him for over potentially around a decade at this point, but he was sort of the new atheist persuasion and classical liberal, but over the years, it's been interesting to view his evolution kind of drifting toward conservatism, but also going from someone who would I maybe classified as anti-Christian to someone who appreciates Christianity. And I interviewed him on the show and we were kind of discussing exactly that. The idea that all of these atheists seem to love Christian culture, but they just don't want the Christianity from it. And I talked to Carl about this. He even described himself as a reluctant and unwilling atheist who admitted that if he could be a Christian, he would, because I think you have to realize that it's not just a coincidence that, you know, Christian culture, Christianity, it's produced, the greatest recognition of human rights we could have asked for, especially coming from what was previously recognized. And I think there's a cognitive dissonance for a lot of these atheist types where they want to essentially have their cake and eat it too, dismiss Christianity as old-fashioned superstition, but when faced with an increasingly secular world, realize that perhaps it wasn't just the un-Christ parts of Christianity, like, oh, culture that were responsible for bearing all of these fruits. Maybe the Christ part of it was actually central, and without it, we just don't have the same results. And that I think should be cause to question, well, why is Christ so central to it? Maybe because it is the truth. But I do want to talk to you about that Doug Wilson interview and Christian nationalism, because like I said, this is such a hot topic right now. Some comments from you guys first. Trav, to the world, men and women need to take on responsibility and accept that condemning sinful behavior is uncomfortable but necessary. Such a good point. And I feel like that's something even I struggle with, like online. I'm not a confrontational person, as some people might disagree with if they follow me on X, but it is hard. And I feel like so many Christians, we default to wanting to be kind and nice and that we don't rock the boat, that we actually maybe fail to stand by our own values. Simon Allen says, prob shouldn't, but feel you speak what you believe, maybe stronger than some. Also, I won't say accomplished and chanting. Oh, well, thank you. The Inquiring Christian, thoughts on Reconquista bringing back mainline Protestant progressive churches to orthodoxy, leave or stay, infiltrate, change. What are your thoughts on that?
Ooh, that's a really good question. You know, so first I would say the institutions that aren't totally lost need to be fought for. Like, I can give you the example of the Southern Baptist Convention seminaries, which right now educate the plurality of pastors and ministers in any Protestant denomination. So, you know, a lot of guys who are not Southern Baptists are going into those seminaries to be trained. And I would say they are teetering on the brink would be a way to put it. And, you know, not to plug my book, but I go into that in my book that, look, you're not a Southern Baptist. That's cool. But you still need to care about what's going on in their seminaries because they're churning out probably your pastors, too. And they are definitely teaching some things that are very social justice, not biblical. And so we need to care about that. They are not lost. So I feel like right now there's sort of a struggle for the soul of those seminaries. So I'm certainly not giving up on those. If you follow me online and you, particularly on X, and you go, why does she tweet about this stuff so much? It's very niche. That's why, because those institutions are not lost. But man, if something doesn't change, they become the main lines, because this exact same fight happened in the 1920s for the main lines. If you look up J. Gresham Machen, he was fighting for this and he lost. Went over, established a new seminary, and now the same thing, you know, however many decades later, is now happening at that seminary. So this is kind of what liberals do, right? Each generation, conservatives build something really sound. The people are attracted to the truth and the reason that they see there. And then the liberals infiltrated and slowly sort of try to co-opt it over time. And so we're seeing that again. So first, man, fight for the institutions we still have. And look, if we're successful at that, yeah, by all means, Reconquista. I'm all about that. I would love to see that happen. But I would say I don't really see much of a biblical model for that success. I mean, typically once they fall, our command is to separate from those who claim Christ, but say you can, you know, have your sexual immorality and other sins as well and still have Christ. You know, we're directly told just separate from that. So, I mean, I think that's more likely what has to happen. But I think if, as the opportunity is there, sure, absolutely. Let's take every institution for Christ that we can.
Right. Justin Baldwin says, Christian Orthodoxy lost ground in the last 20 years in a bid to appeal to a more compassionate side while compromising truth and scripture. Craft of the World says, Dawkins' truth says how to make guns, not when to use. Interesting and true. One of the problems of atheism and the worship of science is that science is, I mean, it's not really prescriptive. It's not normative. It's not really a moral guideline to live by. But let's talk about Christian nationalism. So you mentioned this. Tucker recently had on a guest that I thought was so interesting. Pastor Doug Wilson, he says, is the Christian nationalist they warned you about. So this is a this was one of the little interviews he did. It's a definitely shorter one. The one he did with that Palestinian priest was around 47 minutes. This is only 8.5 minutes. So I recommend you guys check it out if you haven't watched it. It's not a long time commitment. Were you familiar with Doug Wilson before? Because I actually was not.
Yeah. I was very familiar. I think I had talked to Tucker and he said, I'm hearing about this Doug Wilson. Should I have him? And I went, yes, have him. So, you know, their church is based in Moscow, Idaho. They have Canon Press. I've been a fan of a lot of what they do for a while. They take a lot of knocks within sort of big evangelical circles because it's funny. You want to talk about sort of the manosphere and doing masculinity. They do some fun videos and they can get a little edgy. And I get why some people have objections to that. I really like it. I kind of enjoy their vibe. You know, on occasion I went, that went a little too far. I might not have used that language. I don't know that I can justify, you know, that particular turn of phrase that was used. But what I would say that Canon Press and Doug Wilson do is that sort of performance that you saw at that goofy conference. Mm-hmm. They will do sort of fun videos that are appealing to young guys, but it is backed up by really deep substance. They are having really serious conversations there about what men's roles are, what men are to be in the church and in their communities. They're having obviously very serious substantive discussions about what Christian nationalism means and what it would look like. And so, you know, I've watched their material for a while, but I thought this interview was outstanding. And it's funny because the way Doug Wilson described Christian nationalism in that interview, I think just about anybody who is a true Christian would agree with. I'm still not totally convinced of the wisdom of accepting the label. I mean, basically what he said is that we're going to get these labels anyway. If you're going to be a Christo-fascist or a racist or whatever, and this is a label that I am willing to accept for my belief set. So sort of redeeming the label. I just don't know. I don't know how effective that is to sort of lean into the leftist smear, because I think so many average normal people look at it and go, they're not going to hear your disclaimers. They're not going to hear, right, we don't want theocracy. They're just going to hear, we want a theocracy. We want a rule by a priesthood. And so, you know, I'm still on the fence on that, but I think that the argument that he presented in that Tucker video was really, really sharp and really persuasive.
And I'm someone who, I've called myself a Christian nationalist previously, years and years ago. And then when people started freaking out about it, I didn't understand why. Like, I could be a Christian, I can be a nationalist. Actually, some people don't even like the term nationalist, but until a few years ago, thought of the term as radical or extreme. You're a Christian. Hopefully you're voting for Christian values. You want to see sanctity of life, etc., in government. That to me is not controversial. Also very firmly believe that rights come from God, not government. Mm. But like you said, even though people like Doug Wilson, he makes it sound very, if you're a Christian, I think it would be very hard to argue against what he's saying. There are people out there who are trying to paint this as a radical extremist concept and movement. Do you think it is inherently threatening for Christians to be mobilized as, I mean, they already are, frankly, but as a voting bloc? Because it seems like that's what the pushback to the idea of Christian nationalism is about. But yeah. I think ironically, time and time again throughout history, we've seen that anytime people do try to, I guess, dismantle Christianity and Christians, try to marginalize and disenfranchise them, it only ends up backfiring. But what do you think about that? Is the fear surrounding the label warranted?
No, not at all. But it's interesting that you bring this up, because you marry that to the conversation we just had about cultural Christianity, and it's kind of a way to have the same conversation with a different name. Because what Wilson advocated in the Tucker Carlson interview was basically Christians advocating their beliefs in the public square and exercising, you know, their constitutional rights to free speech, free assembly, you know, backing candidates, funding candidates and organizations in the same way that everyone else in the country does, right, and arguing that it's better when Christian principles rule a society, which is kind of exactly what Richard Dawkins just said. So in a way, his cultural Christianity was really kind of very similar to what Doug Wilson said. Now, what Wilson said further, which I absolutely agree with, is that we are not going to get that without a whole lot of preachers preaching true gospel, not social, justice issues. And in fact, he used the phrase, and I loved it, hot gospel. We need preachers preaching hot gospel. And I'm like, yeah, we do, because you are not going to get that kind of societal transformation without real revival and without transformed individual hearts. And so that's the part that I go, I don't think anybody who is a Christian would disagree with that. And I don't think that there is anything to fear. In fact, there is everything to gain from Christians arguing for their policy preferences in the public square and being successful at that, because we are seeing what the other side gets. What you get is a lot of death and a lot of chaos and a lot of disorder, mm-hmm, where we don't even know what men and women are. So the people who are critiquing it, again, I think they're critiquing something that doesn't exist. Look, I'm sure there are some fringe people who want a theocracy, who want no separation between the church and the state in the sense that the church is ruling the state. That is not what I saw Wilson argue for. That's not what the, right, people who use the phrase Christian nationalism, they are arguing for, distinct spheres of the government wielding power over the state and the citizenry and the church wielding power over those who are part of the body in the church, which they should. I mean, everyone sort of gets freaked out by the word power, but that just means, having the ability to, execute plans and policies and discipline. And those are good things. We need people to hold power. Otherwise you have no structure and you have chaos. So a majority of what I have seen is it's propaganda. It's a smear campaign by the left. There was the Rob Reiner documentary where they made it explicitly clear that they included things like the Dobbs decision as part of Christian nationalism, as a victory of that movement. Well, how did we get the Dobbs decision? Exercising constitutional rights in the very same way that the left did. You know, they've been mobilizing, working for years through all of the, you know, legal channels, every legislative opportunity available to them. So how is that Christian nationalism, just using the system that we have? And, you know, you're seeing the same thing with Tim Alberta, who just did this, you know, kind of ridiculous book from The Atlantic, and it's been hailed. And I read the thing and I went, you're just mad that Christians are daring to get involved in the political process in the way that they always have. Like, he actually had a part of the book where he said, you know, guys like Jerry Falwell back in the 1980s glommed on to, you know, opposing abortion and homosexuality being promoted in schools and, you know, a list of other things that were pretty basic Christian beliefs. And I'm like, I don't know. It feels like maybe the Bible just had something to say about those things. And, you know, maybe that was the reason that the first century Christians also opposed those things that you're talking about. So, you know, I don't know what Jerry Falwell's motivation was, but it seems pretty obvious to me why Christians in the 1980s, just like Christians today, said, gosh, we don't think you should kill babies. You know, we think, yeah, Jude 1 means it when it says these things are immorality.
And it's interesting because when the left argues for things based on their moral perspective, they act, and it makes sense as though this is simply a matter of good versus evil. But when Christians attempt to do something like advocate for life on the principle of sanctity of life, then all of a sudden it's, well, why are you telling me what to do? Like, all of a sudden, a lot of leftists become maybe libertarians and surprisingly laissez-faire. Like, why can't you just keep your opinions and beliefs to yourself? It's like, when have you or the left in ever been for keeping your opinions and beliefs to yourself? I think there's this tendency to conflate Christianity with authoritarianism. You know, I have not really seen that from the Christian nationalist movement. You know, as a mom, as a Christian, I care about right to life. I care about, you know, school choice, being able to, hey, send my kid maybe to a Christian school or homeschool them and still having my tax dollars that I give anyway, support that. That to me is what I see when I see Christian nationalists. But yeah, maybe that's just me and I'm not seeing all the scary extremists that I keep hearing about. K. Max McDonald, is there a country in the West or the world where Christianity is most thriving? Does it thrive more in poorer countries? I feel like there's a larger Christian nationalist movement going on in some of these Eastern European countries. I don't know about you though, Megan.
Yeah, no, that seems to be true. And also, you know, in Africa, we've seen some countries like Uganda who they're directly saying, we don't want your Western interference. And you're seeing some of their churches breaking away going, your churches are corrupt. We don't want to be a part of your United Methodist Church anymore because you have completely sold out. And so they're leaving. And what's interesting is then you sometimes see American evangelical leaders like Russell Moore sort of chastising Uganda. And I'm like, you're mischaracterizing what some of their laws are and you're getting involved in saying like, oh gosh, they shouldn't apply biblical principle to their own governments. I'm like, how is that not you from the U.S. are, you know, have the audacity to say that the Ugandans shouldn't be able to structure their own civil government and their own laws the way they want. And yet you're warning about people having, you know, power overreaches, Christians having power overreaches in the United States. So that was really interesting to me that I kind of went, you know what, why don't you let the Ugandans work this out? Because one, you're mischaracterizing their law. And two, biblically, they're not wrong. So, you know, that was a big issue to me. But I feel like what we really have to drill down on is the way they use the word power. I mean, I just feel like anytime they use the word power, it's like this big, scary thing. And, you know, you've seen a lot of pastors do that who kind of, you know, win the accolades of your New York Times and your Washington Post. But I'm like, power is just the ability to enact policy. Mm-hmm. And that's important. I mean, we all get to have a role in pursuing our particular policy preferences. So anyway, I feel like it's just a thing that they use. And so they're, oh, the Christian nationalists want power. And I'm like, And what do the secularists who are pursuing different policies want?
Right. And I don't think it's controversial to say, to advocate for in behalf of women power, black power, you name it. But I think there's a knee-jerk reaction to the idea of Christian power. Again, like not a theocracy, but Christians who have power and, you know, are trying to instill Christian principles when it comes to government. I don't think it's actually anti-power. I think, like you alluded to, it's anti-Christian really at its core. The Inquiring Christian says, would recommend The Case for Christian Nationalism by Stephen Wolfe and looking at Canon Press for more on Christian nationalism. Free Gender also says, if abortion is really life deletion, then the doctor needs to be charged with first degree life deletion because he is the hitman, and the mom needs to be charged with first degree life deletion because she is the hirer. I mean, here's the thing. It's hard for some pro-life people to come out, and we spoke about this, and condemn this as like murder, this should be illegal, but simultaneously say absolutely no consequences for breaking that. That's not the way other laws work, regardless of the law. A law is only as good as its enforcement mechanism.
Yeah, and look, I think people recognize if you're serious, if you're saying that this is the killing of a child, then it is logically inconsistent to say that both parties who are involved in that killing aren't going to face any consequences. Now, we can argue about, you know, what the level of the consequence is, but it is logically and morally consistent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this argument that you see from sort of the pro-life lobby that the women don't know what they're doing, I will grant that maybe in a small number of cases with very young women, they don't fully understand the moral gravity of the action that they're taking. But I'm going to be honest, I think that's pretty rare. I mean, look, we see these women shouting their abortions. We've seen the TikTok videos of the women who, you know, kind of make jokes about killing. I mean, they'll make jokes about, I am going to kill my baby, ha, ha, ha. They know what they're doing. So this argument that women, and by the way, describing women as somehow lesser, I mean, in a way, it infantilizes women. And it's a way that we get to sort of have our cake and eat it too, right? We're both so self-actualized that we can make these choices, but at the same time, we're so not naive, we don't know what we're doing.
Right. And actually, this the next thing I want to talk to you about is a little bit of a different beat, but still very interesting. So Andrew Tate, he's tweeting up a storm again. He put out this post that had a lot of people, well, let's read it. I don't even know how to describe it without ruining. He says, dear white men, you're effed already off to a strong start. You're being replaced because none of you have children. Even those of you bitching about the replacement online like little girls don't find the gumption to F word. I see white men bragging about having 5 kids as if it's an achievement. LOL. 5 lol lol per year, right? Oh, all you white boys lost control of your women, and now they won't accept multiple wives anymore. Now they tell you they don't want any more kids. One's enough. They don't want to do their God-given job anymore. No, they want Instagram likes instead. So your genetic potential is stumped by the whims of some singular female, a female who takes 9 whole months to grow a single baby. I don't, like, should we be doing it faster? I don't know.
Don't be so lazy, Lauren.
I know, right? Speed up the baby making. Other races have multiple ovens for bread. We're not cucked. Some B-word is screaming at you about loyalty and you're sitting there saying, yes, baby, pleasuring yourself to porn when she's asleep or maybe cheating with someone else with a condom. So many points to be made here. Oh no, I couldn't get another one pregnant. My wife would kill me. Total losers. Soon your race will be nothing more than a few pages in a history book. A lesson on what happens when you F the female psyche so hard they're obsessed with money and social media as opposed to being one of many baby factories for a king. 30 children minimum for the Dons. White people, go talk to your best friend wife about what to do this weekend. Maybe you can take a nice walk around IKEA. Enjoy extinction. Okay, so this did get community noted. Fertility rates have been falling in all parts of the world and among all races. The fertility rate of non-whites has fallen more than that of whites. What?
Where to start? What? There.
Yes. Where? So many things. So many things.
I mean, and it's all kind of connected. We'll go all the way back to the Mark Driscoll thing that I go, if you do not shape men's roles through biblical Christianity, you're going to get some wacky things. And men unrestrained from Christianity traditionally become tyrants. I mean, in most societies throughout the history of the world, you had men as tyrants because they're stronger and can dominate women. And that's, you know, that's what happens when you have unredeemed men and you have an unredeemed masculinity. The idea that men were to care for and protect women, one wife, that is the biblical principle. And we see what happens when you get away from it. I mean, it gets twisted and obscene really fast. That's what we just saw was that obscenity. I mean, there's nothing nobly masculine about what Tate just, I mean, I don't even know where to begin to take it away, but you go, so his idea of masculinity is just impregnating a bunch of women and not caring for your children is what it sounds like.
Well, it's interesting that he makes it sound as if, oh, it's only maybe because of feminism that you guys are not having polygamy anymore. Polygamy from a European perspective was never really a thing. I mean, England, Spain, Portugal, we had these great European empires that managed to do really well without the practice of polygamy, right? There was nothing wrong with the birth rate of white people during that time when they only had one wife and things were still going. So it's interesting. He's trying to tie the, you know, decline of the birth rate to not having polygamy, even though polygamy doesn't really increase your fertility rate as a whole race because you don't have more women, right? It's just, you know, you like a woman can either be pregnant or not. It doesn't matter if she's also a sister wife to another woman, if that makes sense.
Well, and I'm almost glad he said this, because if you remember a few weeks ago when Andrew Tate kind of came out with his Christ is King thing, as a Muslim, a lot of people were like, look, even this Muslim man is recognizing that Christ is King. And I'm like, no, he's not. Because what he means is something very different than what a Christian means when they say it. And what he clearly means is apparently just some sort of male dominance. And when I look at this, I go, if Christ is King, everything you just said is abhorrent to that culture. So he's sort of wanting some sort of cultural Christianity. And that's why cultural Christianity doesn't work, because a Christianity that is not, has not truly transformed heart and mind, you end up with something real nutty like that.
Yeah. And that's what I want to tell Andrew Tate. Like, Christ is King. Here's why Christ does not approve of what, I mean, from a biblical standpoint, but like I said, even just from a historical standpoint, a biological standpoint, polygamy does not increase your birth rate as an entire race, if that's what he's concerned about, because you won't have more white women who could be pregnant. And not to mention the fact that polygamy, historically, it has been an unstable, I guess, societal construct, because you end up with a lot of disenfranchised and single men. If it's not one-to-one, then you're going to have angry men out there who are single. And I think we already in society have too much of a problem with, you know, male singleness and this gender divide. I don't think just solidifying it and say, all right, one rich guy, all the women, that's not going to make anything better. So this was just a wild take.
Wild. Yeah. And that's the kind of thing you go, so is this the sort of thing that, you know, is sort of always lurking in Andrew Tate, and every once in a while it just comes out and he says the sort of quiet discomfort everyone has with him really loudly, and you go, oh, right, that's why I feel uncomfortable with him, in case we all forgot. And, you know, when you look at it, he also doesn't deal with the fact which you just brought up, which is there is no stronger foundation for a society than the quote unquote nuclear family unit, a mother and a father and children. Right. And so, you know, all of the sort of disaffected, unattached young men are exactly what he's tapping into. And I'm going to think, you know, pretty cynically tapping into, and he's, you know, profiteering off of that. And I think to a certain degree, that's also what we're seeing is, you know, there's a shock value. And there are a lot of angry young men who have been left out of our society culturally on purpose. And this is how he is monetizing that in really ugly ways. But this to me is somebody you go, you have no understanding of what built strong societies, that men taking care of women and their children, that is what built empires. I mean, right. show me right now anywhere in the world. I mean, if you want to look at the Muslim world, where are men with multiple wives, you know, where are they building great civilizations? I don't see that anywhere.
Right. Even, I mean, in the United States, you have the fundamentalists, that LDS sect. They're not doing hot because, again, this is actually a very weak societal model, the polygamy. But I feel like it's almost become a LARP or a meme for some of the, you know, the red pillars who are not only reject feminism, but also reject Christianity because they view it as too feminine, not only in the way that it's currently being modeled. Because like you said, yeah, I think there is a femininity problem in a lot of churches. Catering too much to female sensibilities is a good way to put it. But they also view Christianity as a concept as inherently feminine because of concepts like turn the other cheek. And of course, we know that, you know, the marriage model that the Bible gives us is one of love and stewardship, which I think they even have begun to resent the idea that a man should be provider and protector for his family. So this seems like almost like an overcorrection in light of all things.
Well, and, you know, going back to him saying Christ is king a couple of weeks ago, I go, yes, he is king, and the model of Christ is as the husband to the bride, the church, is that he gave himself up and sacrificed himself for her. So the command to husbands is to do the same, is to give yourself up for your wife, even unto death. So it's not to, you know, become the servant to your wife. It's not to, you know, become the inferior to your wife. It is, in fact, to lead and to serve, and that service requires your sacrifice. I mean, everything he's described there is, I mean, gosh, it's ultimately so self-serving and greedy. I don't know a different word for it other than I just want to amass women. I want to amass children, not because I feel that I have any obligation to care for them or to sacrifice anything of myself for them, but just to what? Glorify myself. So there, you know, there's nothing of Christ in that. So it's interesting when you see it, because you go, he clearly, you know, when he posts things like that, had no understanding of what the Christian model is. And in a way, he is the mirror image of what you see on the left, who they also have no real in-depth understanding of what Jesus taught, which, you know, when he said, love your neighbors, he also said, you know, you love your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the Ten Commandments, the law, tells you what love is. So love wasn't just I feel that you were kind to me, therefore I know what love is. No, Jesus told us what love is in the law. That mirrors for us how we love our neighbors, even if they don't feel like that's love. That's how love is defined. So, you know, you've got Andrew Tate on this side sort of saying these things about impregnating, I don't know, dozens, hundreds, I don't know where he puts the limit of women. And that is no different than, you know, the absolute sexual chaos that you see on the left, where they are also, interestingly, endorsing polygamy, but they'll call it polyamory. For totally true. Different reasons. And I go, man, you guys are no different from each other.
I'll fight you, Nega, with a good point here. Under polygamy, you use up men in war on enemies. And I saw people responding to Tate kind of arguing, you know, polygamy or monogamy only benefits women. No, actually, it only benefits men. And it's one of those interesting things where, I mean, ultimately, both like Red Pill and feminists might be arguing against it, but it's because they each view the opposite sex as using marriage as a tool to restrain or control them. Very much in the red pill, like, oh, men don't benefit from marriage. It's just a way for women to control you. And that's even regardless of the divorce conversation, because there are good points with family court that are brought up. Feminists, of course, we know they think that marriage is patriarchal and it's a way for men to control women. And it's just, it's interesting to me. I believe very much like by their fruits, you will know them. Ultimately, if the end goal is the same, it's just polygamy, a polyamory, whatever you want to call it, then I'm going to view like your movement is no different from the feminists. I'm sorry, but that's just, that's how.
And by the way, Richard Dawkins, both sides of this chaos is what you get when you are only trying to ascribe Christianity as, you know, a cultural phenomenon and not an individual relationship. So it needs to be both. It needs to both inform our culture, but it's not going to inform our culture if you don't have actually redeemed citizens.
No, absolutely. So we have a few more minutes here, guys. If you have any questions for Megan, be sure to get them in. But Trapped of the World, children yearn for the minds, women yearn for infantilization. Look at the success of BLM among even conservative women. They want to export moral agency. I haven't seen much BLM activism amongst conservative women, so I'm going to disagree there. But I think, yeah, there is a desire to export moral agency. And I think for a lot of the virtue signaling we see amongst leftists, that's exactly what it is. It's a lot easier to post a black square and then consider yourself a good person than actually have to make moral choices and perhaps even lifestyle changes every single day. We know how much K-Max McDonald. We know how much American Christians love Israel, but how are Christians treated in Israel? I hear mixed messages on how they are treated there. I've never been to Israel myself, so anything I hear about it is only from, outside sources. I don't have any personal experience. I don't know if you've been, Megan.
Yeah, I haven't been, but look, I know how Hamas treats Christians, and it's not good. So, I mean, we know that the Christian population there in Gaza is not going to criticize the ruling Palestinian authorities. So, whenever I hear this conversation, I kind of go, look, I am no expert on this region and what's happening there, but I know that I probably don't want to appeal to terrorists as who's going to look to the best interests of Christians.
Well, I feel like there's room there to, I guess, be critical of Christian treatment in Israel without trying to be like, oh, well, but Hamas are teddy bears, which we know that there is a lot of, criticism of Israel that's not just anti the IDF, but actually pro Hamas, which is really interesting. I always thought that was a meme, but there are leftists out there who actually will justify Hamas as like politically legitimate. But I'm of the belief that maybe this would be less of an issue and people would talk about it less if we were not sending all of our tax dollars on there. Actually, that was a point that Laura Loomer and I discussed last week. If you guys missed that episode, you should definitely check it out.
And that's always an issue. I mean, what our national interests are, that I always feel like is a totally legitimate discussion. My big thing is, maybe we need to discuss, what we're sending over there in terms of our treasure and our resources. And, I think that's a totally legitimate conversation to have. Different question than, what that guy asked as far as how are Christians treated. And I am no expert, so I don't know. I largely kind of stay out of foreign policy because I'm so buried in, cultural issues in the United States that I try not to speak about them too much because my ignorance will be revealed. But, as far as how the church has handled that discussion, I do feel like it is legitimate to question how our resources are being spent.
And I feel like, like you just said, there's definitely enough cultural issues stateside to keep someone busy time and a half. Inquiring Christian says, love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law, Romans 13:10. Bobo says, what does this lady think about Candace getting fired? I don't want to put you on the spot.
I'm going to pass. I'm going to hit the pass button.
Fair enough. That's happened to me too. Like, when you're part of a network, people assume that you're privy to every single, it's like, no, it's not.
I really, and I'm remote. I'll be honest with you. I didn't know anything. I don't know what happened in the background. The nice thing about being a remote person from Charlotte is sometimes I go on Twitter and I find out what's happening from everything everybody's posting. I'm like, oh, wow, huh, didn't know that.
Yeah, relatable. I know I'm remote too. Like we were talking about before the stream started, Blaze has a little studio in Nashville. Most people are in Dallas. So, in some ways, we're kind of out here on our lonesome. But Megan, thank you so much for joining. Reminder, guys, her book is going to be out did you say July?
Yes. So it's out in July, July 30. So we're getting a jump on, early promotion, pre-orders. I got a text from an email from my editor this morning saying, wow, that one tweet really drove some pre-orders. So thank you for boosting it, Lauren. And thank you to everyone who pre-ordered. And if you haven't, do, because you need to care, man. Even if you are not an evangelical, what happens in the evangelical churches impacts you dramatically.
Absolutely. And guys, if you want to check it out, pre-order, the link is going to be below in the description, as well as where you can follow Megan on social media. So definitely check her out. She's anytime that I see one of her tweets, it's always something really impactful and oftentimes raising attention about an issue that I wasn't aware of previously. Sometimes I feel like people in this space, we tend to glob onto the same issues. You're like a little breath of fresh air often, where it's like, oh, I actually didn't know this was happening from anyone else. So definitely check her out. And thank you again, everybody, for tuning in. We will see you next time on Pseudo Intellectual Live. Take care.